With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Organic growers in quarantine regions worry about citrus greening threat. As an organic citrus grower and packer in Ventura County, John Wise has long recognized the threat of the Asian citrus psyllid to his business and livelihood. The threat has become greater now that part of his region is under quarantine as state agricultural officials continue to find more residential citrus trees infected with Huanglongbing, also known as citrus greening disease. It's a fatal bacteria infection that the Asian citrus psyllid insect can transmit. For organic citrus growers, there remain few effective treatment options approved for organic production to control that psyllid. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. CAPCA gets $1 million from CDFA to support SPM practices. The California Department of Food and Agriculture, through its Sustainable Pest Management Pilot Grant Program, has awarded $1 million to the California Association of Pest Control Advisors. This money will fund a two-year project which evaluates statewide pest management practices, also known as SPMs. The project is said to develop data on existing practices and utilize that data to produce new educational courses for trained pest control advisors. CDFA Undersecretary Christine Birdsong says, quote, PCAs are our boots-on-the-ground partners and have a firsthand experience with the multitude of pressures that our producers face every day. The information they will gather through this pilot study will provide a clear analysis of the pests our producers are addressing. This information is essential for understanding the current state of the pest management and the impact of any future changes. CAPCA's project aligns with the state's new pest management strategy, Accelerating Sustainable Pest Management, a roadmap for California, which is integrating a whole system approach that promotes human health, resilient ecosystems, and economic viability in agriculture production. The data collected in this project will be combined efforts from the California Pest Control Advisors, partnering with PCA commodity groups, growers, as well as CDFA scientists. Those partners will analyze practices on pistachio, grape, tomato, and lettuce productions. PCAs will receive stipends in exchange for consistently reporting that detailed information. Once evaluated, a curriculum will be developed of SPM continuing education courses targeted at filling in gaps in SPM training. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The Soil Health Institute has partnered with the Climate Smart Cotton Program to provide field-level mentorship and technical support. Research soil scientist with the Soil Health Institute, Diana Bagnell, details the value of localized resources.
This is based really on the idea that knowledge about soil health is really local. And so we have soil health educators that work for SHI coordinating the program. They're working with local technical specialists. So those might be folks in extension who really know what's going on the ground, as well as farmer mentors, people who have already been successful with these practices and can help others who want to learn. As we all know, we've got, you know, extreme weather. We have market uncertainties. There's so much we can't control. And thinking about how we can make our communities and our farm systems as resilient as possible is so important. But I think it's a great time to be able to invest in soil health because I think it really is a win for our growers, for society, and for the environment.
Funding to develop safer pest management techniques or expand their adoption is now available through annual grants sponsored by the Western Integrated Pest Management Center. A total of $320,000 is available for three grant programs, and proposals will be accepted through December 8th. Western IPM Center Director Matt Bauer said that this year the maximum funding per project has been increased to $40,000. Project initiation grants support the launch of new IPM ideas such as proof of concepts, preliminary experiments. Workgroup grants bring together diverse groups to address information, resource, and research needs in region-wide or broad area categories and enhance communication and collaboration within the region. Outreach and implementation grants build on previous IPM research by providing outreach to encourage implementation of IPM practices. More information about the grant opportunities is available at westernipm.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the Waters of the U.S. rule continues to nudge into the spotlight. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee held a hearing on the Waters of the U.S. rule titled Examining the Implications of Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency for the Clean Water Act Protections of Wetlands and Streams. I talked with committee member Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota this week about that hearing.
Sure. Well, first of all, the hearing was set up by the majority to consider the ramifications of the Sackett versus EPA decision, which implies by its very title, oh my gosh, what are we going to do now that the Supreme Court has clarified what the Waters of the United States is for us, as opposed to thank God the Supreme Court clarified what the Waters of the United States is for us. And it was clearly slanted toward the environmental position. And whereas Sackett versus the EPA really was less about the environmental or the pragmatic outcomes and more about the Constitution and the law itself. And so in some respects, like is often the case in Washington, I felt like you had two sides sort of talking past each other, neither one of them necessarily wrong, except that the EPA made a decision. Their job is to make decisions based on whether this fits the Clean Water Act and the Constitution, not whether or not how much this will either enhance or degrade, the waters, the prairie potholes, for example.
Senator Cramer says the Supreme Court decision should have cleared things up, but that's not necessarily what happened.
In previous cases in Rapanos, for example, Antonin Scalia defined a navigable water, a certain way with a little more defined. And it's because the court's reluctant to define for the agencies and for the legislative branch that there's been this regulatory ping pong that would go back and forth. Well, this latest case, the Sackett case, the court did put further definition into what's a water of the United States, remembering that going all the way back to the Clean Water Act in its genesis, Waters of the United States was based on the term navigable. Navigable being, a river that moves up, where you can navigate or move a product from market to market, from state to state, thus interstate commerce. Since that time, the Clean Water Act has come to mean waters that can run into a navigable water. So, a persistent stream or river or a lake, but not a ephemeral one or an occasional one or seasonal waters, things like that. And that's where the definition got cloudy. Well, Alito made it really clear, it seemed to most people, but there's just enough lack of clarity, I guess, in the minds of the agencies that they thought they could sort of stick with this, occasional stream, seasonal rivers that could contain some continuous flow during certain times could continue to be considered navigable or waters of the United States. And so in the new rule, in my view, they violated already the Alito decision and the Alito interpretation of what's the waters of the United States. And I tried to point that out, as you notice, in the hearing rather specifically.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Meat Export Federation was pleased with this week's announcement that the U.S. Department of Agriculture will make funds available aimed at expanding opportunities for U.S. ag products in the international markets. John Herrett has more details.
USDA announced it will make funds available through the Commodity Credit Corporation for a regional agricultural promotion program to expand opportunities for U.S. agricultural products in international markets. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom welcomed the news and said it's very timely as the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program is coming to an end.
USMEF would definitely like to thank Secretary Vilsack, staff at USDA, and congressional leaders that support this program through the CCC, prioritizing international market development. We're excited about the opportunity. The ATP, or the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, that was put out 4 years ago that finishes up next year, USMEF's actually finished up our program, the ATP program, earlier this year. And that has just been phenomenal in terms of the opportunity to create additional value for our members and our pork and beef producers all over the country. The fact that there's another opportunity here will allow USMEF and other cooperators in other parts of agriculture in the U.S. to maintain some of this momentum in the export markets.
Hallstrom said the additional funding could be especially helpful in emerging markets.
The ATP, or the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, allowed us to not only overcome some of the trade obstacles that we had at that time, but allowed us to go into some of the newer markets around the world and really establish a footprint. Colombia, for example, where we were able to get aggressive. Also, the Philippines was another area on beef and pork where we were able to get aggressive. We would have been involved in these markets anyway, but not nearly to the extent that we ended up being able to invest in those markets. And these emerging markets are where really the opportunity is long term. And whatever we can do today to invest for the future, there's no doubt that there'll be payback over time.
For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harris.
Thanks, John. And the National Milk Producers Federation and U.S. Dairy Export Council are also pleased with USDA's announcement that it plans to devote $2.3 billion from the Commodity Credit Corporation to promoting better market opportunities abroad. USDA will devote $1.3 billion to establishing a regional agricultural trade promotion program, $1 billion to commodity-based international food aid. NMPF President and CEO Jim Mullen said now more than ever, the U.S. dairy industry relies on exports. If distributed to those sectors that are presently underfunded, such as dairy, the new export promotion funding will put us in a better position. USDEC President and CEO Krista Harden said, "We're thankful that USDA is taking this important step to support America in agriculture. These resources will fund programs that will strengthen the U.S. dairy industry through the creation of new markets and the promotion of nutritional dairy-containing products in food aid." I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Students are gearing up for the National FFA Convention. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. FFA members and supporters from across the country will celebrate agriculture and agricultural education next week at the 96th National FFA Convention and Expo in Indianapolis. The time-honored tradition will take place November 1st through the 4th. More than 65,000 FFA members from the United States, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands are expected to attend. The general sessions will take place at Lucas Oil Stadium. Convention events begin on the first day when Expo attendees can explore various career pathways in agriculture and attend attend leadership workshops. FFA members and advisors can also take their skills to the next level in student and teacher workshops. They'll hear from industry leaders, motivational speakers, and many other guests. Members will get to discuss their agricultural projects on the new student showcase stage. Service will be front and center at the event as members will participate in service projects with various sites in Indianapolis. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. It's not uncommon for farmers to encounter the need to have their farmland formally valued. Lenders have a keen interest in understanding the value of assets utilized in the farming operation. Also, valuation is an issue when estate, business, and succession planning is engaged in. The starting point for valuing farmland is to correctly denote the number of acres. What are the total acres? What are the taxable acres? What are the tillable acres? Often, total acres defines the total area within a legal description and makes no reference to quality or any restrictions on title, such as easements. Taxable acres is tied to assessed acres, and tillable acres are those that are used in crop production. Recent developments in technology have made it easier to accurately determine tillable acres, and certifications to the USDA can also help determine tillable acres. But tillable acres does not include areas that cannot be farmed, such as waterways, fence rows, timberland, creeks, and similar areas. Make sure that the valuation is accurately measuring the type of land at issue and breaks it out properly. Also, make sure that legal descriptions are accurate. Local government offices, such as the county recorder and county auditor, can be helpful in determining and assuring the accuracy of legal descriptions. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
It's a new partnership among the nation's animal health and biodefense facilities to improve early detection of emerging animal diseases. This is Christy Loyacano, coordinator of the National Animal Health Laboratory Network within USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service.
We're going to identify five scientists and place them in five of our non-laboratories around the country with the intent of them to take their region, look at the threats both nationally and internationally, do risk assessments, and then make sure that the laboratories that are non-laboratories within their region have the capability to respond to those threats.
Chosen labs will partner with the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility.
We're partnering with NBAF and their expertise in the foreign animal disease diagnostics and utilizing what NALM can provide in that partnership.
Each participating laboratory offers a specific area of study based on region and scientific category.
We have three level one laboratories, which is the highest level of our non-laboratories. They take on the most responsibility and typically do the most testing for us.
Those facilities include the New York State Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at Cornell University.
They do focus on multiple species and will be developing assays both on the serologic and molecular side of things.
Michigan State University's Vet Diagnostic Lab.
A multi-species leader, and they'll focus on whole genome sequencing, which is an up-and-coming area for diagnostics.
And the Washington State Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory.
They're going to focus a little more on avian and aquaculture, as well as the wildlife interface, so the interface between domestic species and wildlife.
The remaining two facilities, level two sites, are based in Virginia and Arizona.
We have Virginia Tech Animal Laboratory Services. They're actually going to focus on swine and small ruminants as well as bovine. So looking more at the livestock side of things and focusing on molecular epidemiology and molecular diagnostics. Out in the Southwest, we have Arizona Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. They are going to be looking between Mexico and U.S. border. They'll be looking along diagnostics and interfacing with indigenous people along the border and also looking at next generation whole genome sequencing.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food,
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Corn and soybean harvest progress ahead of 10-year averages, but Mother Nature may catch up starting today. I'm Mark Oppold with the Bottom Line Report, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Well, the country song, "The Lights Are On, But Nobody's Home," comes to mind today. Where rains haven't started yet, combines are running long hours, the lights on, and no one's home because family members are out running loads to and from the field. Rain will delay some areas now through the weekend, though, but that delay could give some elevators time to make room for that last 25% to 30% of the harvest. December corn building a base at 480, March building one at 490. Watch those numbers. Brazil nearly out of exportable soybeans. January beans below 1290 should attract some buyers. This is the Bottom Line Report. Discover the entire lineup of combines, forage harvesters, tractors, balers, and more at Kloss.com. Cattle traders, we think now, seem to have fully absorbed the negative cattle on feed report from last week. December low on Tuesday, 177.30 should be watched from here. December lean hogs low on Tuesday, 65.95 will also be a support number to watch. China's sow herd is now back near 42.5 million, building, but still far from all-time highs over 44 million. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Social Security checks will see a 3.2% increase in January of next year. AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says that's welcome news for seniors who are paying more for everything from gas to prescription medicines.
Retirees can rest a little easier at night knowing they will soon receive an increase in their Social Security checks, on average of $59 per month, to help them keep up with rising prices. Older Americans are still feeling the sting when they buy groceries and gas, making every dollar important. They should know, too, that there are several other options available to help them keep up with rising prices.
With Medicare enrollment now open through December 7th, Voskel says it's important to know how to save money on your premium.
The best place for more information is your state health insurance assistance program. It can give you personalized help choosing a Medicare plan for free. Check out the Medicare Savings Program and Extra Help, which could save you money with premiums, deductibles, and copays. These programs could save seniors more than $2,000 and $5,100 per year, respectively.
However, Voskel says older adults leave billions of dollars in government aid on the table each year and don't even realize it.
That money could go to cover utilities, rent, healthcare, prescription drugs, and groceries at a time when inflation remains stubbornly high. Look for programs such as the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. With this program, recipients get a one-time payment to help defray winter heating costs. The payment can be as high as $1,400, although the average payment is $500. AARP offers information available on this and many more at aarp.org.
Learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD-TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Clements reporting.
The likelihood of a farm bill extension. As the House continues its search for a new speaker, some members of the Senate are watching and waiting for the legislative work to continue, especially when it comes to the farm bill. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota expects a farm bill extension.
Senator Bozeman, ranking Republican on the Senate Ag Committee, has suggested a one-year farm bill extension.
The senator says an extension is a good option in this case.
Really, the last five-year farm bill is still pretty good law. And I think agriculture by and large, and more importantly, the extension of agriculture being the banker, can live pretty well with an extension of the current farm bill, and certainly much better than one that actually runs out of money and runs out of authorities.
He says an extension will provide a sense of certainty for farmers who need to make decisions for the next year. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Yes, we are almost to that special spooky night, Halloween.
And in some places, kids are still going door-to-door, trick-or-treating, which is fine if we parents work on keeping kids safe and feeling safe. This from University of Kentucky Extension Child Development Specialist Dr. David Weisenhorn. He says, Halloween is a different experience for people depending on their ages. Older teens and adults in recent years have really gotten gruesome, explicit in their costumes and how they decorate their yards.
And it can be very frightening for young children.
And he said there's a house near him that has bloody body parts hanging all over the yard. So Weisenhorn's advice to parents:
if you have young children, maybe to avoid those homes.
Now, beyond the psychological aspect, he says there can be real safety issues, physical ones, involved in trick-or-treating. And so, first off,
children under the age of 12 should certainly be accompanied by an adult. If they're 10 or 11, maybe they walk to the door by themselves from the sidewalk. But younger children should certainly be accompanied the whole way, so they're not alone. And even older children, as they get into the teenage years, make sure that they have some friends that they're going around. It's just not a time for anyone to be alone.
Next, with younger children, after dark, they need to be able to be seen, especially by motorists.
Maybe that's as simple as putting a small flashing light. So if we can have something to either clip onto the costume, that way you don't have to alter the costume, or being able to add easy reflective strips to the costume can be very helpful and can add that little bit more safety.
Now, besides being able to be seen, the kids need to be able to see everything around them. And oh, how many times as a kid did I fall on porch steps because I couldn't see them all with the mask on. And so, parents,
make sure that any mask that a child's wearing doesn't restrict their vision to the point to where they could be in danger.
And on the subject of costumes,
make sure that the costume is not too long and that it could get tangled around the foot. Pick up any loose ends or trim a costume to keep a child from possible tripping or falling.
Oh, many's the time I tripped on my Superman and Dracula capes. I guess I was kind of a klutz. But anyway, more seriously, once the kids return home with their huge haul of candy and such,
I think it's important now for parents to dump out all the candy and to give it a good once-over. And one, you're looking for are all of the candies individually wrapped and has that seal or wrapper been broken in any ways? And if it has, simply tossing those away is the best idea. It also gives you an opportunity to determine if your child does have an allergy or a peanut allergy or maybe an allergy to something else. It gives you an opportunity to look to see what is in the candy.
And a chance maybe to steal some of the stuff that we like now, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. Guilty laugh there, huh? So this is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, and have a happy and safe Halloween.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. We were able to catch up with Senior Manager of the Almond Board's Field Outreach and Education Team, Tom Duvall, at the recent CAPCA conference.
And we're going to be seeing you in several weeks now here coming up at the Almond Conference. And you're going to be part of a panel looking at irrigation technology, correct?
Yeah, so we're going to do a session on automation and control. You know, this is an area that really, if you look at what we're doing at irrigation management, it's the next step on really efficiency. So taking automation, using the data you've got, and now really being able to execute on it.
And what's going to be, who is going to be participating in this panel at Almond Conference?
So we're going to kick it off with a review of the T-Rex project, a research project we've been doing that's really providing the information, the how and what and how long you need to irrigate. And then from that, we're going to jump into a panel discussion. It's going to be a different format. It's not going to be PowerPoint slides. It's going to be a panel discussion with four different companies that work in the space.
So this will be kind of a back and forth between maybe how some of this has worked kind of on the ground with different entities there?
Yeah. So we're going to cover things like, you know, how to choose a system. Should it be wireless? Should it be wired? You know, really getting nuts and bolts of it. You know, what are the risks of doing it? How to protect yourself from deadheading a pump, things like that. So a lot of detail and having four different companies. They all have different specialties, and it's going to be really, I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a great panel.
And just kind of overall, I mean, what kind of value does some of this technology offer to growers in terms of just the overall benefits or the value of maybe coming and checking this out and learning a little bit more about it?
You know, a great question. It's a great time to look at costs. You know, when you look at control, you've got to send somebody out to the field to actuate that valve. Having that be automated, that person can be off doing other things. They're not focused on having to get back to the valve by 12 o'clock. So it really helps both in just labor savings and on making it your execution better. So they get there at 12 exactly. The valve actuates exactly when it's supposed to actuate, not 2 o'clock because they got busy fixing something else and didn't get to it. So it really helps from that perspective. And this year of all years, with all the money, incentive money through programs like SWEEP and things like that, it's a great year to kick this off and you know, have the government step in and help you down that path.
And just to dig in a little bit more on that subject of you know, this being the time to maybe invest because of some of those programs, what are maybe some other incentives or funding availability out there to implement some of this important technology?
You know, both the USDA have Climate Smart Agriculture funding this year, and the SWEEP program is a record amount of money this year for SWEEP. So both of them are really good programs to look at.
And just to get an idea of when this is going to be happening during the Almond Conference, what day is this panel, and maybe where can people get some more information on Almond Conference in general?
So for information on Almond Conference, go to almonds.com. And for the panel itself, it's going to be on Wednesday, so the middle of the conference in the afternoon.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. A new study offers a farmer viewpoint on precision tech. A new study from the South Dakota State University investigates farmers' viewpoint on the most influential factor behind adopting new technologies and practices, and that's profitability. In the study, researchers highlighted 8 widely adopted precision ag technologies, including auto steering and guidance, automatic section control, satellite aerial imagery, variable rate fertilizer application, variable rate speed in application, variable rate pesticide application, and variable rate irrigation application. The most widely adopted precision ag technologies include auto steering and guidance, which fit under the georeferencing technology category. Satellite imagery was the next most widely adopted technology, with nearly 60% of all farmers having used it. Drones and unmanned aerial vehicles fall under a similar category to satellite imagery. However, drones are much less prevalent, with an adoption rate of 26%. To further facilitate precision ag adoption, the research team noted that financial support during the first few years of adopting a new technology could be beneficial. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters contributed to that report.
Food insecurity in the U.S. as of 2022 is up from the previous year. Among the findings in USDA's latest edition of the Household Food Security in the U.S. report released Wednesday.
Food insecurity increased from 10.2% in 2021 to 12.8% in 2022.
USDA research economist Matthew Rabbit says that reflects the number of households that had difficulty at some point during the year providing enough food for members of the household due to lack of resources. In addition,
in 2022, 5.1% of U.S. households had very low food security, and this was statistically significantly higher than the 3.8% that was estimated in 2021 and the 3.9% estimated for 2020.
8.8% of children were food insecure at times in 2022, up from 6.2% the prior year. Rabbit adds the majority of household demographic groups report year-over-year increases in food insecurity. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Farm Bureau this week named the 10 semifinalists that will compete in the Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge. American Farm Bureau Director of Industry Relations, Chase Heineman, says the teams of entrepreneurs will compete for startup funding.
We're super excited to have announced the top 10 semifinalists for the American Farm Bureau's Ag Innovation Challenge. We've had a really great crop of companies from the applicants who submitted applications for this coveted program now in the 10th year, and are really excited to get them to conventions to compete for much needed capital to help expand their businesses.
Heineman says the program offers competitors valuable training and insights, as well as networking and exposure.
We have some partners that are going to provide some pitch training through Cornell University. We have some opportunities for them to engage with potential funders at convention. They will be able to connect with our members. And then, of course, they'll compete for up to $165,000 in award money that will help them expand their businesses and continue to provide those services and products.
He says the Ag Innovation Challenge highlights unique and creative ideas in agriculture.
The agriculture sector is a sector that's full of innovative ideas, and people are really trying to meet the challenges, not only that farmers and ranchers are facing, but the entire planet is facing. And we're very thankful for our partners to helping us highlight these innovative companies, Farm Credit being our major partner, as well as our sponsors, Bayer, John Deere, Farm Bureau Bank, Farm Bureau Financial Services, and T-Mobile.
Learn more about the semifinalists at fb.org/challenge. Michael Klimitz, Washington.
This is the most significant update in organic regulations in over 30 years.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack Wednesday announcing final regulations that will govern the conditions under which certified organic livestock and poultry are raised. Vilsack telling reporters,
it establishes minimum outdoor space requirements and ready access to outdoors for livestock and poultry. The rule carries forward indoor and outdoor living condition requirements, sufficient space for animals to move freely, bedding that is in a large area, comfortable and hygienic. Specific density for poultry requirements.
When these rules take full effect, producers won't be able to market their products as certified organic unless they meet those humane care standards. And so,
this rule makes organic the gold standard for animal care.
Nate Powell Palm is a Montana organic producer, chair of the National Organic Standards Board, and he says these new rules will boost interest in and sales of organic products for all producers. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Vilsack on why ag trade promotion efforts are important. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack explains just why USDA international trade promotion programs are relevant.
It is clear to us that the key to trade promotion and to trade opportunities involves making sure that we continue to support people in country who are representing and working for the United States and the United States agriculture to promote our goods and products. It's important that we continue to have a presence in those key agricultural market areas. It's important for us to continue to do the trade missions, which we've done on an expanded basis in a number of traditional, but also in a number of non-traditional market opportunities to continue the diversification effort. It's also critically important that we continue to provide resources for promotions, working with our cooperator groups across the world to make sure that customers in countries across the world are aware of the quality, the quantity, the safety, and the affordability of American agricultural exports.
Among those celebrating National Cooperative Month this October, Rural Business Cooperative Service Administrator Karama Neal. She explains how this part of USDA's Rural Development Mission Area supports rural cooperatives nationwide.
We have a cooperative services branch, which manages quite a bit of our work with cooperatives. They provide technical assistance. They collect statistics on agricultural cooperatives and do just a wide variety of work around cooperatives. We also provide grants directly to certain types of cooperatives through competitive grant-making programs. We also do a lot of financial services work, lending, guaranteeing loans, and those loans sometimes come through credit unions, which, of course, are cooperatives.
Much of RBCS this work is in partnership with sister USDA rural development agencies, such as the Rural Utilities Service, which oversees rural electric and telecommunication cooperatives. Also,
the Rural Housing Service guarantees mortgages, many of which are made through credit unions.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.